Hello and welcome to the Learning College. Today of the diaspora people part that is kind of at the very front. So A People That Shall Dwell Alone has 8 chapters, then a bibliography index and about the author. But at the start is Diaspora People's preface to the first paperback edition. So the issue I have, the copyright is 2002, Writers Club Press, an imprint of iUniverse, Inc., iUniverse, out of Lincoln, Nebraska, ISBN 0-595-22838-0, A People That Shall Dwell Alone. Let's dig into it. Diaspora people, starting on page VII, Roman numeral 7. And we'll go more into McDonald and his meaning as we go, because we'll have a lot of different sessions, so we'll have a lot of time for that. But basically, this is a way of understanding Jews, a new modern scientific, biological way of understanding them. And McDonald has a background in psychology, and he was a professor in the Cal State system. I think he's retired now as we read it, but he had tenure, and that's the way he was able to write this and get it published without being fired, although they did come after him once he had published the book. And we'll talk more about that type of stuff as we move along. Today, let's look at diaspora peoples, sort of the preface, if you will. Diaspora peoples, page VII. A people that shall dwell alone, Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy, hereafter PTSDA, was originally published in 1994 by Prager Publishers, an imprint of Greenwood Publishing Group. And they're out of the Northeast, and they're mainly an academic press. It is the first book in a trilogy of books on Judaism. The second book is Separation and Its Discontents, Toward an Evolutionary Theory of Anti-Semitism. McDonald, 1998, hereafter SAID, so PTSDA and SAID. And the third, and the most significant and important for our political purposes, is The Culture of Critique, an Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual and Political Movements. That's McDonald, 1998/2002, hereafter C of C. And he, I think, in 2002, he added a bunch about Jews in media at the start. PTSDA develops the idea of a group evolutionary strategy. That's a key thing here that we're learning. Group evolutionary strategy. What does that mean? Working as a group to evolve and having a strategy. What one might term an evolutionarily significant way for a group of people to get on in the world. The book documents several theoretically interesting aspects of group evolutionary strategies using Judaism as a case study. So it's one example of a people using a strategy, a group evolutionary strategy. These topics include the theory of how group evolutionary strategies, the genetic cohesion of Judaism. Well, let me read this. Jews managed to erect and enforce barriers to gene flow between themselves and other peoples, resource competition between Jews and non-Jews, how Jews solved the free rider problem, how some groups of Jews came to have such high IQs, and how Judaism developed in antiquity. This preface updates several of these topics by discussing recent relevant research. However, the bulk of the preface describes several other groups that, like Judaism, have developed group structures that, at least for a time, serve to keep them separate from surrounding peoples. So there are a lot of different aspects to this group evolutionary strategy. Like Jews, several of these groups developed as ecological specialists, so they find their niche where they can get by. And he's kind of looking at them as an animal. Subtitle, Recent Research Relevant to PTSDA. One issue of PTSDA that keeps coming up is the theoretical status of groups and group selection, e.g. Crippen 1997, Hartung 1995, Sanderson 2001. These are references to papers in the academic literature. I'm continually amazed at the extent to which evolutionists have been indoctrinated, mainly by Richard Dawkins, against supposing that groups have any important role to play in human evolution. The problem comes about for two reasons: failure to comprehend cultural group selection, and failure to appreciate the extent to which selection between groups has shaped the human mind. Regarding cultural group selection, I have very little to add beyond the material in Chapter 1 of PTSDA. Formal models of cultural group selection continue to be elaborated, e.g. Richardson and Boyd, 1998, but it has always seemed to me that the basic principle was so obvious and easy to understand that formal models were not really necessary. There is a critical difference between humans and other animals that renders all of the arguments against group selection moot. It is simply this: humans are able to solve the free rider problem by monitoring and enforcing compliance to group goals. So far as we know, animals can't do this. As a result, although there may well be limits on the extent to which natural selection can build stable cohesive groups, much less altruistic groups, in the absence of massive genetic overlap, these limits do not apply to humans. Humans are able to solve the free rider problem, the problem that organisms would tend to take advantage of group membership without. Soldiers in virtually all modern armies serve because they are conscripted. If they attempt to evade dangerous duty, they are shot. Consider the practices of the Soviet Army in World War II. Following the German invasion in 1941, the Soviet Army relied on, quote, "the infliction of the greatest possible compulsion and terror, combined with an endless propaganda campaign intended to ensure political sway." That's Hoffman, 2001. It's a year that relevant. Usually a lot of these are going to be papers, not even books, appeared. Disobedience of even minor orders could result in immediate execution. The result was a cohesive group where individual interests and individual goals mattered little. Judaism and the other group strategies discussed here did not, of course, use such draconian methods, but at a theoretical level, it is no different. As discussed in Chapter 6 of PTSDA, in traditional societies, there were a variety of controls on the behavior of individual Jews that ensured that group interests prevailed, including paying communal taxes, guarding against freeloaders, creating pressures for charitable contributions, and respecting business monopolies held by other Jews. These phenomena are, of course, by no means restricted to Jews. Bohm, B-O-E-H-N-9, shows that human hunter-gatherer groups have been characterized by an, quote, "egalitarian ethic for an evolutionarily significant period, long enough to have influenced both genetic and cultural evolution." The egalitarian ethic implies that meat and other important resources are shared among the entire group, the power of leaders is circumscribed, free riders are punished, and virtually all important decisions are made by a consensus process. The egalitarian ethic thus makes it difficult for individuals to increase their fitness at the expense of other individuals in the same group, resulting in relative behavioral uniformity and relatively weak selection pressures within groups. Mild forms of social control, such as gossip and withholding social benefits, are usually sufficient to control would-be dominators, but more extreme measures, such as ostracism and execution, are recorded in the ethnographic literature. By controlling behavioral differences within groups and increasing behavioral differences between groups, Bohm cogently argues that the egalitarian ethic shifted the balance between levels of selection and made selection between groups an important force in human evolution. So he's citing evidence that proves that group evolution is a real and important thing. It's not just individuals the way it is with animals. Recently, Fair and Gechter, G-A with an umlaut, C-H-T-E-R, Fair and Gechter, 2002, found that people will altruistically punish defectors in a one-shot game, a game in which participants interact only once and are thus not influenced by the reputations of the people they are interacting with. Subjects who made high levels of public goods donations tended to punish people who did not, even though they did not receive any benefit from doing so. Moreover, punished individuals changed their ways and donated more in future games, even though they knew that the participants in later rounds were not the same as in previous rounds. Fair and Gechter suggest that people have an evolved negative emotional reaction to free riding that results in their punishing such people, even at a cost to themselves, hence the attribution of altruism. These results are of great importance for thinking about situations where people help strangers and situations where future interactions are not anticipated. Essentially, Fair and Gechter model the evolution of cooperation among individualistic peoples. Their results are therefore least applicable to groups such as Jews, in which traditional societies were based on extended kinship relationships, known kinship linkages, and repeated interactions among members, so they're more close-knit than the white Aryans who are spread out and individualized. In such situations, actors know the people with whom they are cooperating and anticipate future cooperation because they are enmeshed in extended kinship networks, or, as in the case of Jews, they are in the same group. The results are most applicable to individualistic groups because such groups are not based similarly on extended kinship relationships and are much more prone to defection. In general, high levels of altruistic punishment are more likely to be found among individualistic hunter-gatherer societies than in kinship-based societies based on the extended family. Similarly, in the ultimatum game, one subject, the proposer, is assigned a sum of money equal to 2 days' wages and required to propose an offer to a second person, the respondent. The respondent may then accept the offer or reject the offer, and if the offer is rejected, then neither player wins anything. The game is intended to model economic interactions between strangers, so players are anonymous. Henrik et al., 2001, found that two variables, payoffs to cooperation and the extent of market exchange, predicted offers and rejections in the game. Societies with an emphasis on cooperation and on market exchange had the highest offers, results interpreted as reflecting the fact that they have extensive experience with the principle of cooperation and sharing with strangers. On the other hand, subjects from societies where all interactions are among family members made low offers in the ultimatum game and contributed low amounts to public goods. Gatherers and groups derived from societies based on extended kinship is important in the following, particularly in the discussion of the Puritans. Again, we're doing diaspora peoples as sort of the preface to A People That Shall Dwell Alone. So setting the Jews in the context, we're talking about the context today. In CFC, Culture of Critique, 2002 edition, I cited evidence showing that European culture derives from North Eurasian and Chinese culture derived from the Middle Old World culture area, characterized by extended kinship networks and the extended family. They derive from cultures prone to in-group, out-group relationships in which cooperation is with the in-group composed of extended family members. Together, these results predict that group strategies deriving from populations of North Eurasian and circumpolar hunter-gatherers, Hutterites and Amish, Puritans, will be more prone to altruistic punishment than those from Middle Old World culture area, Jews, Gypsies, Chinese. As indicated below, Puritan groups seem particularly prone to bouts of moralistic outrage directed at those of their own people seen as free riders and morally blameworthy. In Chapter 8 of PTSDA, I discussed how selection between groups appears to have been particularly important in Jewish evolution. This discussion was expanded in SAID and in the preference to the first paperback edition of COC, McDonald, 1998-2002. None of this material contradicts the fundamental evolutionary dictum that selection at the individual level is of paramount importance. Indeed, selection at the individual level is axiomatic. A common thread of these discussions is that, in general, people monitor the costs of group membership and abandon groups when individual needs are not met. However, I also argue that there is a critical mass of Jews and others who do not appear to have an algorithm that calculates individual fitness payoffs by balancing the tendency to desert the group with anticipated benefits of continued group membership. These people are at the extreme collectivist end of the individualism-collectivism continuum. So they're extremely collectivist. So extreme that they are prone to martyrdom rather than abandoning the group. So the reality is that they're part of the group, and that's the number one thing, more than being individuals, to the Jews. These people are obligated to remain in the group no matter what, even to the point of killing themselves and their own family members to prevent the possibility of becoming a member of the out-group. The classic example is the response of groups of Ashkenazi Jews to demands to convert during the pogroms surrounding the First Crusade in several areas of Germany in 1096. When given the choice of conversion to Christianity or death, a contemporary Jewish chronicler noted that Jews stretched forth their necks so that their heads might be cut off in the name of their Creator. Indeed, fathers also fell with their children, for they were slaughtered together. They slaughtered brethren, relatives, wives, and children. Bridegrooms slaughtered their intended and merciful mothers, their only children. In Chazan, Chazan, 1987, 245. The many examples of Jewish martyrdom throughout history suggest that there are no conceivable circumstances that would cause such people to abandon the group, go their own way, and become assimilated to the out-group. Not being converted to Catholicism. So they are going to pose a continual threat because they stick together because that's the source of their power. And they, even if it costs them death, they have to stick together because when they're able to live and not be threatened, they will dominate everybody else, is what you see. And that's why I argue you have to exterminate them, because there is no other solution to it. And he's saying the different psychology and ways of living that we have make it very hard for us to compete with them unless we consciously realize what they're up to and mirror it, which is what the Nazis did. But we'll hear about that farther down the road. I do not suppose that such an extreme level of self-sacrifice is a pan-human psychological adaptation. As is the case for many other psychological adaptations, there are important individual differences, McDonald, 1991, 95, and Wilson, 1994. Conceptually, this range of individual differences in personality systems and mechanisms related to social identity and individualism slash collectivism may be seen as representing a continuous distribution of phenotypes that matches a continuous distribution of viable strategies. At one end of this variation, it appears that there are a significant number of humans who are so highly prone to developing a sense of shared fate with other members of their in-group that they do not calculate individual payoffs of group membership and readily suffer martyrdom rather than defect from the group. This implies that between-group selection must be presumed to have occurred among humans. It is likely that enduring, bounded, discrete groups of people have been a common feature of the social environment for many humans. Levine and Campbell, 1972. This implies that a great many humans have in fact lived in group-structured populations where the status of in-group and out-group was highly salient psychologically. Jews are, of course, a prime example, and several other examples will be discussed in this preface. It is noteworthy that Middle Eastern societies are characterized by anthropologists as, quote, segmentary societies. Middle Eastern societies are segmentary societies, organized into relatively impermeable groups. Sort of think like clans, e.g. Kuhn, 1958-153. Eichelman, 1981, 157 to 174. Individuals in these societies have a strong sense of group identity and group boundaries, often accompanied by external markers such as hairstyle or clothing, and different groups settle in different areas where they retain their distinctiveness. Jews originate in the Middle Old World cultural area, Burton et al. 1966 or 1996, and they retain several of the key cultural features of their ancestral population, including a proneness toward between-group conflict. They don't get along with others. The Middle Old World, capitalized Middle Old World culture group, is characterized by extended kinship groups based on relatedness through the male line, i.e. they are patrilineal. These male-dominated groups functioned as military units to protect herds, and between-group conflict is a critically important component of their evolutionary history. There is a great deal of pressure to form larger groups in order to increase military strength. Barfield, 1993. Cultures from the Middle Old World culture area are not only highly collectivist and ethnocentric, marriage tends to be endogamous, i.e. marriage occurs within the kinship group, and consanguineous, i.e. marriage with blood relatives, including the uncle-niece marriage sanctioned in the Old Testament, is common. It's a way Jews would marry off their nieces to a rich uncle. This suggests that groups from this area should tend to retain their genetic integrity, even if they become diaspora peoples dispersed in other lands. Recent genetic studies have confirmed the genetic integrity of Jewish groups discussed in Chapter 2 of PTSDA. These studies confirm the Middle Eastern origins of Jews, rather than the Khazar theory, which is wrong and false. The Middle Eastern origins of Jews and show that Jewish groups have remained genetically separate from the peoples they lived among over the last 2,000 years. So they're among us, but they are not us. Based on Y chromosome data, Hammer et al. 2000 found that various Jewish populations, Ashkenazi, North African, Kurdish, Yemenite, and Near Eastern, were not only closely related to each other, but also closely related to other Middle Eastern groups, Syrians, Lebanese, Palestinians, and quite separate from European groups. On the assumption that there have been 80 generations since the founding of the Ashkenazi population, basically in Poland, the rate of genetic admixture with Europeans has been less than 0.5% per generation. This level of genetic admixture, again, 80 generations, less than 0.5% per generation. This level of genetic admixture is consistent with supposing that there has been essentially no conversion of Europeans to become mating members of the Ashkenazi gene pool. The very low levels of genetic admixture with Europeans may well have come from clandestine matings and rape. Two other recent Y chromosome studies also found that Israeli Jews derive from the Middle Eastern gene pool. Nabel et al. 2000-2001, N-E-B-E-L. Nabel, 2000, found that 70% of the Y chromosomes of Jews and 82% of the Y chromosomes of Palestinians belong to the same chromosome pool, suggesting a common ancestry. However, Nabel et al. 2001, found evidence that Jews are even more closely related to the Kurds. Muslim Kurds were located near Kurdish Jews and between Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazi Jews. When compared with European populations, Ashkenazi Jews were more genetically distant from European populations than they were from Sephardic Jews. And they were also closer to Arab populations, e.g. Palestinians, Syrians, Lebanese. Sephardic Jews were genetically distant from both Spaniards and North Africans, despite having lived among them for centuries. I think Disraeli, writing about Sephardic blood in his novels, Coningsby, and the other one. Indeed, they remained very close to Kurdish Jews, a finding the authors attribute to genetic continuity with Jews exiled by the Assyrians in 723 BC and the Babylonians in 586 BC. Kurdish Jews remain closer genetically to Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews than to Kurdish Muslims, a truly remarkable finding, since it indicates no detectable genetic admixture between Kurdish Jews and their hosts over approximately 2,700 years. Finally, despite some differences, there is a great deal of genetic affinity between Sephardic and Ashkenazi Jewish groups, confirming the findings of Hammer et al. In 2000. Now, next, some other evolutionarily interesting groups. So that shows you how closely related genetically Jews are. Even Sephardic and Ashkenazi is what we usually hear about, that 90% are Ashkenazi and 10 are Sephardic. They're still very closely related. So, next subtitle, some other evolutionarily interesting groups. The area of group relations remains a fairly untapped field in the area of evolutionary perspectives on human behavior, so this stuff isn't really widely studied yet. All of the groups discussed here live within a larger culture, often as a minority group. In some cases, they have a specialized ecological niche within the larger society, and their interactions with the surrounding society have ranged from peaceful cooperation to animosity and competition. Not uncommonly, there have been eruptions of violence. First group to look at, Roma, or the Gypsies. Based on linguistic and genetic evidence, the Roma, Gypsies, derive from India. Based on vocabulary of basic words, grammatical structure, and sound correspondence, the Romani language has been found to be of Indian origin. Fraser, 1992-95. Romani is similar to Sanskrit, but developed after it. It shows close affinity with several modern Indian languages, but assignment to any one modern Indian language group remains controversial. Based on linguistic evidence, Fraser suggests that the Romani originate as an Indian low caste of wandering musicians, but the issue of the origins of the Romani within India remains controversial. The genetic evidence is consistent with the origins of the Roma as a small founding population splitting from a single ethnic group in India. Genetic data on neutral polymorphisms and mutations have showed a great deal of divergence among Romani groups, resulting from genetic drift and different degrees of admixture with surrounding populations. Kaleideva, Gresham, and Kalafel, 2001. Roma populations are more genetically heterogeneous than our indigenous European populations, presumably indicating an older history. So they're actually more mixed than Europeans, and they probably because they've been around longer. They will say that Europeans descended, or blue-eyed people descended from seven mothers, or and blue-eyed people came from one person ultimately. Roma populations are more genetically heterogeneous than our indigenous European populations, presumably indicating an older history. They stem from, quote, a conglomerate of founder populations which extend across Europe, but at the same time differ within individual countries, and whose demographic history, internal structure, and relationships are poorly understood. Same three people, Kaladjeva, Gresham, and Kalafel, 2001. The authors suggest two, quote, equally plausible scenarios, original founder populations being highly genetically segregated via strict endogamy, a small founder population that undergoes genetic drift. In any case, the Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA data indicate a great deal of genetic commonality and common ethnic origins, Gresham et al., 2001. The Asian mitochondrial DNA haplotype M was present in 27% of Romani women. The Asian Y chromosome haplotype VI68 was present in all 14 Romani populations sampled and constituted 45% of the Romani Y chromosomes. The authors note that one subset of this Y chromosome was present in 33% of the men, indicating the preservation of a particular male lineage on a par with that found for Jewish priests. Kohenim. Kohen is always signified a the rabbi set. Kohenim. See Skorecki et al. 1998. Hammer et al. 2000. The mitochondrial data and the chromosomal data indicate that diversity arose within Roma lineages from mutation rather than intermarriage. The most likely origin of Roma males was, quote, a profound bottleneck event, Gresham et al., 2001, 1328, i.e. that Roma males originate from a very small population with limited genetic diversity. The data indicate greater female diversity in the founding Roma population. Geography was not correlated with genetic distance among Romani populations. However, genetic distance was associated with using a different Romani dialect and a different history of migration, especially for females. The authors attribute this to strict endogamy for females by Romanian-speaking Roma. However, some admixture is indicated by the results for two haplotypes whose frequency among the Romani reflected the clinal distribution pattern in Europe for these two haplotypes. These two haplotypes accounted for 29% of Romani Y chromosomes. Presently, there are 8 to 10 million in Roma in Europe, 8 to 10 million Roma, 8 to 10 million gypsies in Europe, with the densest concentrations in Eastern Europe and the lowest concentrations in Scandinavia. Caldeva, Gresham, and Calafell, 2001. The first records of the gypsies in Europe west of the Balkans date from the early 15th century. Gypsies appeared rather suddenly in the historical record, posing as Christian pilgrims under leaders with impressive titles. Quote, in the entire chronicle of gypsy history, the greatest trick of all was the one played on Western Europe in the early 15th century. Close quote. Fraser, 1992, 95, 62. Since it was a Christian obligation to aid pilgrims, especially pilgrims with documents of recommendation from rulers, gypsies began their sojourn by taking advantage of the Christian piety of the age. The gypsies produced letters of passage from high government officials, such as King Sigismund of Hungary, representing themselves as penitents for the sins of their ancestors who had rejected Christian teachings. As a result of the sins of their ancestors, they were required to wander the earth as pilgrims, seeking charity from others. At first treated with respect, gypsies soon acquired a reputation as thieves, fortune tellers, and horse traders of dubious honesty. An early 15th century German chronicle stated, quote, they were great thieves, especially their women, and several of them were seized and put to death. In Fraser, 1992-95, page 67. Similarly, an early 15th century Italian chronicle noted, quote, the women of the band wandered about the town, six or eight together. They entered the houses of the citizens and told idle tales, during which some of them laid hold of whatever could be taken. In the same way, they visited the shops under the pretext of buying something, but one of them would steal, for they were the most cunning thieves in the world. Same Fraser reference, page 72. In the following century, the status of the gypsies deteriorated from being subsidized as pilgrims to being persecuted and expelled because of their thieving ways. So it's not just Jews who get expelled, but gypsies got expelled. And the gypsies aren't Semites, so they couldn't have been expelled for anti-Semitism. They were expelled for Semitic-type behavior, though. In later centuries, descriptions of gypsies as thieves derived from multiple independent sources throughout Western Europe, from Scandinavia to Italy and Spain. Yeah, they'd say to your kids in Spain, be good or the gypsies will steal you. The stereotype of gypsies included exotic, colorful dress and being of a different ethnic group, distinguished by dark skin and other physiognomic features. Another motif was the gypsy woman as a fortune teller, along with her child, who would steal from the customer. The most common gypsy occupations were seen as that of beggar or fortune teller, but gypsies were also seen as horse dealers, metal workers, and musicians. The general picture associated with them, quote, theft, lock picking, purse cutting, horse stealing, casting of spells, and general witchcraft and trickery. Same Fraser reference, F-R-A-S-E-R, page 124. Typically, there would be sporadic resistance to gypsies soon after their arrival in an area, quote, as some villagers and townspeople tire of almsgiving, page 126. Within 10 to 20 years, there were widespread conflicts, and these tended to be followed by edicts of expulsion in later decades, although the latter were not often enforced, or were often not enforced. There were also attempts at forced assimilation, as in 1767, when Empress Maria Theresa of Austria forbade gypsies to set themselves apart in language, dress, or occupation. In 1773, gypsies were forbidden to marry each other, and children older than five were taken away to be raised in non-gypsy homes. This is similar to what Australia did with some of the Aborigines, tried to turn them into whites. A similar policy of forced assimilation was introduced in Spain in the 17th century and persisted for 150 years with varying levels of severity and success. For example, in 1746, gypsies were restricted only to certain towns, with a stated goal of having one gypsy family per 100 residents of the town. There were severe penalties for engaging in a wandering lifestyle, culminating in the imprisonment of between 9,000 and 12,000 gypsy men at hard labor from 1749 to 1765, Fraser pages 157 to 164. The general tendency throughout Europe was to either banish gypsies or force them to settle down in one area rather than persist in a traveling lifestyle. And they eventually made it over to the USA, and they practiced like driveway sealing scams as well as their more traditional stuff. Gypsies who settled down tended to gravitate to certain occupations such as metal workers, musicians, woodworking, and construction, all occupations where they were self-employed but did not require education. Fortune-telling has remained a gypsy niche throughout their history into the present. In 19th century England, gypsies offered inexpensive goods and services to rural populations, e.g. day laborers and repairing household items. With urbanization, they moved from village to town, where necessary and abandoned old trades in favor of new activities more suited to the times, but without compromising their freedom, their ethnic identity, or their occupational and residential flexibility. Fraser, 222. In Bulgaria, men repaired metal utensils, sold and trained animals for performances, while women engaged in fortune-telling. Marushiakova and Popov, 1997-108. A general trend down to the present is for gypsies to avoid wage labor, such as work in factories. Another common trend is for gypsy children not to be enrolled in school or to be enrolled at much lower rates than the surrounding populations. For example, in the 1980s, in the European community, only 30 to 40% of gypsy children attended, and half had never been to school. The illiteracy rate among adults was typically over 50%, and in some areas over 80%, Fraser, 289. The Roma have a fairly elaborate social structure based entirely on kinship, in which kinship relationships become ever more diluted as one moves from the immediate family to the Rome nation, R-O-M. In the Romani groups living in the United States, studied by Sutherland, 1975, the basic household consisted of a three-generation extended family, often including more than one married child and their children. At the next level, Romani families are organized in familia, consisting of several related families, typically under the leadership of one individual, usually a male, the rombaro, or the big man, who has exhibited leadership and negotiating abilities. Closely related households constituting a familia tend to live in nearby areas. The next level of organization is the vitsa, V-I-T-S-A, or tribe. The Vitsa, sometimes translated as clan, Fraser 238, is not a face-to-face social grouping, but rather a set of familia descended from a common ancestor. Families from different Vitsas avoid living near each other, but do regard each other as Rome. In addition, the Kumpania, K-U-M-P-A-N-I-A, is a social grouping of households and familii. It is not based on kinship, but rather serves to regulate interactions of diverse Rome who are working in a particular area. A cumpania may consist of only one familia that actively prevents non-relatives from being members, or it may include familii of different vitsas who live in an area and are subject to the economic, political, and moral regulation embodied in the Rome legal system. The highest level of social organization is the Natia, or nation, N-A-T-S-I-A. In Sutherland's 1975 study, there were four Natia operating in the U.S., the Makwaya, Lowara, Calder Asha, and Churara. Spelled as they sound, pretty much. These groups have different dialects, customs, and appearance, but acknowledge the others as Rome. Four Natia, the Makwaya, M-A-C-H-W-A-Y-A, Lowara, L-O-W-A-R-A, Calderasha, K-A-L-D-E-R-A-S-H-A, and Churara. The Cris Romani is the main Romani legal institution. It serves as a mechanism for resolving economic, e.g. infringement of fortune-telling territory, stealing from another Rome, and social disputes and contracts, e.g. marriage and divorce. The Cris Romani, K-R-I-S, and then Romani. It's like their own private courts the way Muslims and Jews do. Members of the same vitsa regard themselves as relatives with obligations to help in time of need. In general, helping and obligations for ritual events, such as funerals, are at the level of the vitsa, which, as we have seen, is a kinship group. Fraser, 239. Finally, the Wortacha, W-O-R-T-A-C-H-A, is a work group formed to accomplish an immediate task, such as cooperating in an auto repair business. Conflicts within Rome society generally occur on the fault lines created by kinship relationships. Close relatives generally cooperate with each other in conflicts, while non-relatives are viewed as untrustworthy. Quote, it can be concluded from the alignment of sides that closeness of kin relationship is the single most important factor in determining political alliance. Sutherland, 1975, 123. Allegiance to other Rome is a direct function of kinship distance in a hierarchically branching social organization. People have most allegiance to their familia, then to their vitsa, and to the campagna, and finally to the Natia. Marriage. The Rome derived from India, where the endogamous subcaste or jatis, J-A-T-I-S, typically defined by profession, like Patel being an innkeeper. Indians own a lot of the independent, that is, non-chain hotels in the U.S., is the primary unit, where the endogamous subcaste or jatis, typically defined by profession, is the primary unit. Marriage among the Rome is endogamous. Endogamous wandering groups based on profession remain common in India, like rat catchers or brickmakers, or and like the Rome, these groups typically have ideologies of purity and cleanness that serve to separate themselves from other groups. Fraser, 43, Sutherland, 1975. Sutherland, 1975, found that endogamy had increased among the Rome in the U.S. since marriages occurred more commonly among closely related vitsi rather than among unrelated vitsi. Fraser, 239, also finds increasing tendencies toward endogamy as well as consanguinity, marriage of blood relatives, although marriage between first cousins is not approved. However, marriages with people from other vitsas in the same campagna may be made in order to create closer kinship ties within working groups. Traditional Rome marriage occurred with bride wealth, but the practices died out in many groups. For the Rome, high fertility is something of a social obligation. Having large numbers of children gives prestige to a family, while a woman who cannot have children is a failure. Fertility in Sutherland's 1975 sample was high, averaging 7 children per family at a time when the total fertility rate in the United States as a whole was approximately 1.9, so they're having more than 3 times as many children as other Americans. The household size was correspondingly large, averaging 8, and with many comprised of more than 10 people. Rome fertility has been a source of friction with surrounding populations. During the 1960s, the communist government of Czechoslovakia embarked on a policy of forced assimilation involving spreading gypsies throughout the population, requiring full employment, and ending illiteracy and, quote, parasitism. So they were even trouble under the communists. Fraser, 278. The 1965 census revealed that 1 out of 11 births was a gypsy. The gypsies had a young population with a very high birth rate, and by 1980, the population had increased over 30% since the 1965 census. They're growing like Amish, almost. During this period, the government pressed women into sterilization after having several children. Conflict between Rome and non-Rome were exacerbated in Eastern Europe after the downfall of communism. Fraser, 289. Whereas the Jews, especially the Ashkenazim, have tended toward a high investment reproductive style characterized by high intelligence and an emphasis on education, the Gypsies tended toward a low investment reproductive style. See Chapter 7. Berezeki, 1993, found a very low sex ratio among Hungarian Gypsies associated with a variety of other traits of a low investment style of reproduction compared to Hungarians. Higher fertility, longer reproductive period, earlier onset of sexual behavior and reproduction, more unstable pair bonds, higher rate of single parenting, shorter interval of birth spacing, higher infant mortality rate, and a higher rate of survival of low birth weight infants. The Gypsies would appear to be a low investment group evolutionary strategy. Or let's put it, the Gypsies would appear to be a low investment group evolutionary strategy. Have a bunch of kids, steal from people, trust people who are closest to you blood-wise, and just keep moving around. That's kind of their way of doing it. Social identity processes and the policing of group boundaries. The Rome think of themselves as morally superior, and this self-appraisal is not threatened by the oftentimes negative attitudes held by the Gadje, i.e. non-Romans, G-A-D-G-E. They enjoy deceiving, Sutherland, 1975, page 8. They enjoy deceiving the Gadje and do their best to prevent outsiders from getting information about them, so much so information about them is difficult, and much of what they tell anthropologists must be taken with a grain of salt. Sutherland, 1975, page 21. And there's a block quote there. We just got a few more pages. For the Rome, this is from Sutherland, page 8, 1975. For the Rome, the maintenance of boundaries between themselves and the Gadje is a continuous, almost daily concern. It is based on two factors. A, social contact with Gadje is limited to specific kinds of relationships, namely economic exploitation and political manipulation for advantage, like, you know, customers for the fortune teller. Purely social relations and genuine friendship are virtually impossible because of the second factor. B, a whole symbolic system and set of rules for behavior, Romania, which place the Gadje outside social, moral, and religious boundaries in a multiplicity of ways, the most important being their marim, ritually unclean status. So this is very similar to the Jews in showing they have a dual code. The Gypsies have a dual code in which they owe nothing to outsiders who are seen as unclean animals. Because of their uncleanness, the houses of the Gadje must be clean with powerful detergents before a Rome family may move in. Gadje are by definition unclean, this is a quote, being ignorant of the rules of the system and lacking in a proper sense of shame. They exist outside the social boundaries, and their places and their prepared food present a constant danger of pollution. Fraser 246. Marim, ritual unclean, M-A-R-I-M-E, Marime, is a pervasive feature of life, doubtless serving to provide a constant consciousness of group boundaries. Marime applies to various functions of the body, food, and topics of conversation. It especially applies to the female body, including sexual organs, bodily functions, clothing in contact with the sexual organs, and discussions of sex and pregnancy. This strong sense of we-they is reinforced by the intensely social nature of Rome society. The numerous social gatherings as well as day-to-day visits are occasions where the Rome talk about each other, gossip if you will. In small face-to-face social groups with the intensive sociality of the Rome, the major topics of conversation revolve around talking about each other. As is typical of collectivist groups, reputation within the group is extremely important. Quote, no individual can afford to ignore anyone's statements concerning his reputation, no matter how unfounded in fact they may be. Doesn't this remind you of Jerry Seinfeld, Larry David, and all those shows and the way that they talk? It's like that. Gossip can make or break a person's reputation, and when it occurs, it must be fought immediately. To ignore gossip would be tantamount to admitting guilt. That's a direct quote from Sutherland, 1975-100. Gossip is thus a feature of the social solidarity of the realm, but it is also a mechanism of social control. And like the Jews and the notion of when they live in the shtetls and everybody knowing everybody else's business and there being no privacy, you can see the very strong parallels here to the gypsies. In-group cooperation and altruism. As is the case among historic Jewish groups, see chapter 6, the Rome exhibit an in-group, out-group morality in which lying to the gage and being secretive and elusive toward them are socially expected forms of behavior. Sutherland 30. Charity to needy Rome is a social obligation. Families have an obligation to take in homeless relatives for at least several months, page 54, and even non-relatives expect to help out. A woman who took in large numbers of homeless Rome stated, gypsies must always help one another, and I could never deny food or shelter to gypsies who need it if I can possibly provide it. If a member of the Compagnia is arrested, there is a concerted effort by all to secure the person's release, including especially collections to pay fines and legal fees. All for one, one for all. On the other hand, attitudes toward the non-Rome world are amoral. The legality of an action is a consideration only because engaging in it might result in penalties, such as being arrested. And again, this is exactly the Jew attitude. Stealing from a gage is not considered immoral, and in fact, the Rome have a myth in which God allows them to steal food and other necessities because a gypsy had swallowed a nail intended for the crucifixion of Jesus. Page 73. Mitigating this sense of in-group morality, gypsy criminal activities tend to be minor. In Sutherland's study, gypsies were typically not involved in felonies like murder, rape, or robbery, but tended to be cited for shoplifting, traffic violations, and violations of the garbage laws. Welfare payments were a way of life for many in Sutherland's sample. There is a pervasive sense of caring for in-group members. Block quote. Generosity is a virtue and a form of insurance for who knows when he will also need economic assistance from the Compagnia. Generosity, mutual aid, and daily economic cooperation are normal patterns of behavior between relatives and are ideals of behavior between all Rome. However, these ideals do not extend outside the social boundary. Economic relations with gage are based on extraction, not cooperation, and are governed by ideals entirely different from those expected between Rome. These ideals include cleverness and effectiveness in extracting money, combined with freedom from gage influence and values. That's Sutherland, 1975, page 96. So dual code is the best way to remember this for dealing with in-group and out-group. Mechanisms regulating conflicts of interest within the group, and we'll finish today with the gypsy stuff, about 3-4 more pages, and then there's other groups that we'll talk about in the next segment, Amish and Hutterites, as we get into white people who are kind of apart themselves or evolving as groups. Mechanisms regulating conflicts of interest within the group. Romani groups are notoriously contentious while nevertheless exhibiting a great deal of solidarity. Again, parallel to Jews. Early accounts dating from the 15th century describe the gypsies as organized under leaders who exact obedience from their subjects. Fraser 71. Rome who violate group norms may be judged to be marime, unclean, and denied social intercourse, including commensality, with other Rome. I guess they sort of ban them, or at least socially ostracize them. Commensality is important because Rome's social life centers around the numerous community gatherings such as parties, baptisms, weddings, and funerals, all of the major social occasions that provide the positive sense of groupness characteristic of the Rome. Quote, for a people for whom communal life is of major importance, and where marriages, baptisms, parties, feasts, and funerals are frequent social occasions, Such a sentence is a much feared and very effective punishment. Fraser 245. As in historic Jewish groups, see chapter 6, a sentence of merime is leveled not only against unclean, is leveled against not only the violator, but his or her family as well, and I guess shunning them in the Amish, so they'll outcast the whole family, thus rendering it all the more effective as a deterrent against violating group norms. Associating with gaje is one means of becoming merime if you're mixing too much with the strangers, the English, as the Amish would say. Associating with gaje is one means of becoming marime, unclean, as in the case of a young woman who accepted employment with a gaje firm. After being found and returned to her family by relatives, this woman and her family were sentenced to marime for a specified period of time. Sutherland, 1975-99, marime decisions are handed down by the Chris Romani. So they, again, all this stuff is peril, ethnic core, punishment for those who mix too much, etc. Rome political power is not egalitarian. Success for a man within the Rome community is predicated on possessing certain qualities: wealth, an aggressive wife, a large family, a reputation for being able to manipulate the gaje, a willingness to help other Rome, and the ability to speak well in assemblies. Such a person may become a Rome baro, a big man, able to wield considerable power within the group by, e.g., settling disputes among other Rome. Ecological specialization and resource and reproductive competition. These are sort of subtitles. The Roma are territorial in the sense that newcomers must get permission from existing families and sometimes pay fees to them in order to settle in an area. Sutherland 32. Such practices are similar to those in traditional Jewish communities where other Jews could not underbid families with trading monopolies, and the local Jewish kahila, that's their Jewish political structure, regulated migration of Jews, of other Jews, into the community. See chapter 6. Rome families attempting to discourage other families from invading their territory would report the illegal activities of the immigrant families to the authorities, itself an indication of the extent to which Rome ecology involves activities perceived as exploitative by the wider society. One of the main functions of Rome leaders was to develop good relations with the welfare agencies and the police departments, the two agencies of the gaje that had the most impact on the life of the Rome, the police and the welfare. There is competition among Rome males to be recognized as an official leader with standing to negotiate disputes between Rome and the authorities. However, the main source of financial support of the family is the wife. Sutherland 71. For both sexes, economic activities are typically carried on in the company of other gypsies, while working with non-gypsies is avoided, especially situations where a gaje would have a supervisory role over the gypsy. The resources important in Sutherland's study were fortune-telling licenses and welfare payments. When resources are strictly limited, as is often the case with fortune-telling licenses, one family tends to monopolize an area. However, if licenses are unlimited, as is the case if fortune-telling is unregulated or if the main source of income is welfare, then the social structure shifts to loose associations in which no one family has a monopoly. The Rome value being able to obtain money from the gaje by outwitting them. Apart from deception and illegal activities, common tactics include making a loud commotion to embarrass the target, alternating flattery and hostility, and begging and pleading. These activities require an extroverted personality type, and the Rome regard shyness as a severe liability. Isn't that interesting? Sutherland, page 71. Adjusting to the assimilative pressures of contemporary Western societies. Sutherland, 1975-4, finds that American Rome are aware of gradual changes toward a more sedentary lifestyle, but notes that they still traveled a remarkable percentage of the time. Her survey indicated that families traveled during the summer months and on average spent 42% of their time on the road, with a percentage rising to 50% for young families. The size of traveling groups ranged from nuclear families to groups composed of closely related extended families. A common strategy was to stay in one place long enough to obtain welfare and then obtain further money while traveling, returning to the original area long enough to maintain their welfare payments and hiding their assets while doing so. Sutherland, 48. However, the importance of traveling extends far beyond economic necessity. Quote, traveling is socially imperative and is incorporated into the whole structure of law, social control, morality, and religious beliefs. 49. So traveling is not a thing they do, it's what they are. Traveling is associated in the Rome mind with all things good. It is a remedy for illness or bad luck. And now that many Rome are settled in urban areas, traveling is romantically linked with earlier times when there were fewer conflicts among the Rome. Traveling is also an integral part of social life. Families travel long distances to be with relatives for extended periods of illness or to mark milestones such as weddings or funerals. There is a six-week-long funeral pomana, P-O-M-A-N-A, an aspect of the intense social life of the Rome. Similarly, in Bulgaria, the traditional traveling ways of some groups of gypsies soon reemerged after the forced sedentarization of the communist period, forcing them to settle in the place. Mariusz Jakoba and Popov, 1997, 110-111. However, there are also permanently settled gypsy villages, described as, quote, poor and wretched, with jerry-built houses or dugouts. Their inhabitants were engaged mostly in dirty, unskilled labor or as servants or musicians, page 118, but there were also some artisans. Fraser, 1992-95, 294 FF, mentioned several other itinerant groups that have appeared in Europe, some of which do not appear to have any relationship to gypsies or are derived at least partly from non-gypsy populations. These include the Irish tinkers, sometimes called travelers, and there was shows about them on the BBC, and they have a lot of the same ways as these Indian gypsies do, even though they are genetically white. And the Quinquis, Q-U-I-N-Q-U-I-S, of Spain and Portugal. So the Irish Tinkers and the Quinquis of Spain and Portugal. These groups share a similar traveling lifestyle, similar occupations such as metalworking and peddling wares, similar preference for early marriage within the group, similar cleanness rituals, and similar de-emphasis on education. These groups are relatively little studied. So that will end our segment today. So that shows you a group that is very similar to the Jews, so that we are able to begin to place Jews in context. They're genetically related people, and they live by a very strong dual code. Now that Romans are ones who travel around, the gypsies, the Jews spread out and are also an international people, but they're not so big on traveling, and they're also high investment, whereas others are low. But a lot of these points, you see where the in-group versus out-group is a very, very, very strong distinction. And that sets them up, as we move forward into the 20th century, to really pick off and destroy a white society by virtue of their cohesiveness versus our comparative looseness. I want to thank you for being with me today. I've been Alex Linder, and as I've said, this is Kevin MacDonald's A People That Shall Dwell Alone, as we start to do his trilogy as an audiobook, and then finish with his Cultural Insurrections as the dessert. And you can find everything we record, as always, at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me. I'll be back with you again real soon.